one way to keep her close. If you're scared and sick and can't think how to live for your own self, try to think how you can live for her. You won't feel helpless anymore. You'll know just what to do. When she ran out of words, she gave the top of my head a twitchy pat, like a person who's nervous about being snapped at might pet a big, strange dog. It was lousy affection, but I knew it took a lot for her to even try, and I appreciated it. Besides, she had let me in far enough to show me a glimpse of her own pain, and an act such as that requires more courage than giving someone a hug. She asked if I'd mind Templeton for a bit while she raked up the nails in her yard. I sat in the garage and watched the kid standing on a bucket of rock salt, banging the keys of the big iron manual typewriter, just about the only thing his father had left behind for him. I sat under his daddy's framed Ph.D. from Cornell. Templeton was a direct descendant of jumpy, pasty geniuses, people more comfortable with microbes on glass slides than with other human beings. I was unclear whether Charlie Blake had died by accident or on purpose, taking his car through a guardrail and down into a canyon after a couple of drinks. Yolanda had gone with Ursula to identify the body while I stayed behind to watch Templeton. Yolanda told me later that Charlie had only just been fired. His company was moving somewhere down south, and they were taking his research and all his best ideas with them, but not him. All he got for a decade of work was a handshake and a gold iPad. The accident had smashed his skull down into his brain, but that iPad had been salvaged from the car crash with nary a scratch on it. Ursula gave it to Yolanda. Ursula couldn't bear to look at it. I sat while Templeton banged at the keys, and I tried to think what Yolanda would have wanted me to do. I had about 30% charge left on my phone and used it to try her father again. This time I didn't even get voicemail. I walked to the open garage door. A mile of blue sky stretched above the Rockies, nothing in it but a few fat, scattered islands of cloud. Ursula stood in the middle of her lawn, leaning on her rake, studying me. At her feet was a small mound of glittering crystal shards. "What are you thinking about?" Ursula asked. "Do you think it's going to rain?" "Might be a sprinkle later," she told me cautiously. "I was thinking I should go see Dr. Rusted. That's Yolanda's father. Someone needs to let him know what happened to his daughter. Easier for me to go to him than for him to come to me. He's 64 and not exactly a triathlete." "Where's he live?" "Denver." "How are you planning to get there?" "I guess I'd have to walk. No one is driving anywhere. The roads are full of nails. You know it's 30 miles. "Yes, ma'am. That's why I was thinking if I'm going to go, it better be soon. If I left in the next hour, I could be back by tomorrow night." "You also could be dead by tomorrow night if you get caught out in another downpour." I scratched my neck. "Well, I'd keep a close watch on the sky and head for cover if it darkened up any." Ursula clenched the handle of her rake and thought for a bit, frowning to herself. "I'm not your mother," she said at last, "so I can't forbid you to go. But I want you to text me regularly to keep me up to date on your progress. And when you get back, you're going to come straight here and show Templeton you're all right, so he won't worry about you." "Yes, ma'am." "I wish I had a gun to give you." "Why?" I said, genuinely surprised. "Because law will be stretched thin, and there's a whole city of terrified people out there. Folks woke up today to a poisoned world, and some of them won't see any reason to hold back on doing the awful things they've always dreamed of." She thought some more and then lifted her eyebrows. "I have a big rusty machete you could take. I keep it around for hacking the brush." "No, ma'am," I said. "If I got into a fight, I'd be just as likely to miss and whack it into my own knee as hit someone." "You better hold on to it. I'll keep to the main roads. I don't think in the bright of day there'll be much to worry about." I turned and went back into the garage. Templeton was all typed out and said he was ready to be a bat. I caught him around the waist and lifted him and hung him upside down from the bicycle rack. He dangled above the filthy stained mattress that was there to catch him if he slipped. "Hey, kiddo," I began.
"I heard it all," he said. "I heard you talking."
"I don't want you to worry about me any. If it rains, I'll get undercover. I'll be fine. You stay in the house or the garage while I'm gone."
"Mom wouldn't let me out anyway."
"No, and good for her. Your days of flying around as a bat are over. Come to think of it, I might have to drop in on the FAA while I'm in Denver and tell them what you've been up to. Let them know you've been flapping around at night without a license. See if they won't clip your wings once and for all.
You better not, he said.
Try and stop me. He hissed like a snake and showed me his plastic fangs. I tousled his hair and told him I'd see him soon.
Don't worry about Yolanda and her mother, he said to me solemnly. If you don't come back, my mom will figure out what to do with them. She'll probably plant them in the garden.
Good. I hope she grows something nice out of them. Yolanda would probably enjoy the idea of coming back as a batch of tomatoes.
Mom doesn't like to hug people, Templeton said, still dangling upside down, his cape hanging almost to the floor. Will you hug me?
You bet, I said. And I did. All I had to do was stroll across the street to get a sense for just how hard hiking down to Denver might be. The road was covered in a carpet of steely needles, a half inch deep. One came through the soft rubber sole of my sneaker and jabbed me in the arch of my right foot. I sat down on the curb to tug it out and yelped and jumped back up with three more nails sticking out of my stupid butt. I climbed the exterior staircase to my crib on the second floor. Below me, Andropov's apartment was full of racket. He had a music player going, blaring operatic Russian music. Toward the rear of the building, there was a TV on, blasting just as loud. I could hear Hugh Grant saying witty things in a sly voice about as loud as God's. Remember, the electric was out all over Boulder. All his equipment had to be running off batteries. I had swept and mopped the entire apartment in preparation for Yolanda's arrival. I had opened a bottle of sandalwood and sage oil, and the whole space had been kissed with the sweet fragrance of the high country. We had only four rooms. The living room flowed into a small kitchen. There were a bedroom and a small office in the rear. The floor was old pine, the long-ago varnish yellowing to a shade of amber. We had hardly any furniture, aside from the bed and a cheap futon below a poster of Eric Church. It didn't look like much, but we had cuddled on that futon, had watched TV there, and sometimes kissed and held each other. Yolanda had kept her favorite pillow in my apartment, and when I looked in the bedroom, I could see it, long and flat in a faded purple pillowcase, neatly lined up at the top of the bed. At the sight of it, just about all the energy for expeditioning went right out of me, and I started feeling heartbroken all over again. I lay down for a while and had a good snuggle with her pillow squeezed against me. I could smell her on it. When I closed my eyes, I could almost make myself believe she was there in bed with me, that we had only just taken a pause in one of the long, sleepy conversations we often had first thing in the morning. We could make a happy argument out of just about anything. Which of us looked better in a cowboy hat? If it was too late for us to learn to be ninjas? If horses had souls? But I couldn't make my lonesome feel bad last. It was too goddamn noisy downstairs. I didn't know how they could do it. Listen to a Russian aria in one room and Hugh Grant in another, all of it turned up to a medium-sized roar. They had to be fighting, I thought, trying to drive each other mad. Wouldn't be the first time the downstairs was full of furious clatter, crashing pans, slamming doors. I leapt out of bed and stomped on the floor to tell them to shut up, and right away one of them replied by kicking the wall. He kicked so long and so hard it shook the whole house. I stomped even more furiously to let him know I wasn't scared of him, and Andropov kicked back harder still. And suddenly I realized I was getting pulled into their childish game and quit. I threw some water bottles into a backpack, some cheese and bread, my phone charger in a case I found a place to use it, a multi-tool, and some other junk I thought I might want. I kicked off my topsiders and yanked down my cowboy boots, black with silver stitching and steel toes. When I went out, I left the place unlocked behind me. Didn't see the point. The rain had smashed in the windows on the exterior landing. The cops were no doubt too busy to worry about a little looting here and there. If someone came along and wanted my stuff, they could have it. The noise from Andropov shook my feelings and buzzed in my head and was more than any reasonable person ought to have to stand. On a last irritable impulse, I turned on my heel and clomped onto the porch and hammered on the door, meaning to ask him what was the big idea. But no one answered, even though I stood there pounding until my fist was sore. It was loud, but it wasn't that loud. I was sure they could hear me. It nettled me, the both of them in there ignoring me. I went to one window, then the other, but both were boarded over on the inside. The glass wasn't even broken, not there in the shelter of the front porch. I went back down the front steps and circled to the eastern face of the house. The nails had come in at a slant from the west, so the windows were intact on that side of the building as well. Andropov had nailed planks across the inside of the glass here, too. The first had been completely blocked up, but when I reached the second, there was an uneven space, about an inch wide, between two planks. When I stood on my tiptoes, I could just peer through the gap. I saw a dark hallway and an open door looking into a dingy bathroom. Plastic tubing curled up out of the tub and into the sink. A glass beaker sat on the toilet, next to a gallon jug of some kind of fluid. What might have been water, but which seemed more likely to be ammonia or some other clear chemical. I rose a little higher on my toes, trying to see what was on the floor of the bathroom. My forehead bumped the glass. An instant later, Andropov's eyes appeared in the crack, bulging and bloodshot and wild with fury or terror. The thickets of his eyebrows were black and overgrown. I could see the pores in his bulging nose. He belted something out in raging, sputtering Russian and pulled a black curtain over the glass. I was tramping across the campus of the University of Colorado Boulder when I saw a guy in a tree, 40 feet off the ground. A man in a dark windbreaker and a red tie, tilted almost upside down, with a branch going through his stomach. I walked right under him. He was reaching out with both arms, and his eyes were open wide, like he was about to ask for help getting down. I couldn't figure out for the life of me how he'd gotten up there. It was a cool, shady morning under the big leafy oaks on the Norland Quad, but you couldn't fool yourself it was just any Sunday morning. A girl ran by me in a blood-soaked Josh Ritter t-shirt, sobbing her guts out. Who knew where she was coming from or where she was going? What might be the cause of her grief? What source of comfort she sought, and if she ever found it? There were shiny nails of finest crystal on the paths, broken windows in all the dorms, and dead pigeons littering the grass. The air should have been perfumed with the smells of late summer, roasted grass and blue spruce. Instead, though, there was a stink of jet fuel. I didn't see the helicopter until I came down a gloomy alley between buildings and had a glimpse through a stone arch into the outdoor theater they have there for Shakespeare and the like. There was a TV newscopter that had gone straight down into the flagstones. The cockpit was a bashed-in nest of steel and shattered glass and blood. The whole craft looked shot up, holes and dents and dings all over it. So that was where the guy in the tree had come from. He had tried to jump when he saw he was going down. Maybe he'd imagined that the oak would break his fall. It had. I came out onto Broadway, which is 4 lanes wide and cuts a straight line through that part of Boulder. When I emerged streetside, I saw for the first time how bad everything really was. There were abandoned cars as far as you could see, windshields busted in, all of them beat up, pocked with hundreds of dents, shot through with holes. Cars had swerved off the road and up onto the curbs. I spotted a ragtop that was just rags and a pickup that had parked in the lobby of a real estate office, driving right through the plate glass window to escape the storm. Someone else had run their Lincoln Continental into a bus stop, plowed it right into the long plexiglass booth where people had crowded together to take shelter from the rain. There was blood splashed up onto the plexiglass, but the bodies at least had been cleared away. 2 blocks down the road, there was a stopped Greyhound riddled with holes. The door was cranked open, and a guy sat on the bottom step, feet in the road. Rangy Latin dude in a blue denim shirt buttoned at the throat, but the rest flapped open to show his bare chest. He held a fist to his mouth as if to stifle a cough. I thought he was mewling to himself, but that was the cat. A horrid, skinny, hairless cat was in the street. One of those things that is all wrinkles and big bat-like ears. This thing was dragging itself around by its front legs, turning itself in a slow circle, trying to find a way to get more comfortable. It had a nail through its haunches and another in its throat. The big guy, his face framed by long, greasy hanks of hair, was crying almost silently, silently and bitterly. His nose had been broken more than once, and the corners of his eyes were wrinkled with scar tissue. He looked like he'd been in 100 bar fights and lost 90 of them. From his dark hair and deep reddish hue, a color like polished teak, he had more than a little vaquero in him. I slowed, crouched down by the cat in the road. It gave me a bewildered, helpless stare with very green eyes. I am no fan of the hairless breed of felines, but you couldn't help but feel dreadful for the sad thing. "Poor little guy," I said. "It's my cat," the big man told me. "Oh, Lord, I am so sorry. What's his name?"
"Roswell," he choked out. "I was looking for him all morning, calling for him. He was under the bus. I half wish I hadn't found him at all."
"You don't mean that," I said. "You've been blessed with a chance to say goodbye. That's more than most got with those they love." "He is glad to see you, no matter how much pain he might be in."
He glared. "You got a twisted fucking idea of what's a blessing."
"I'm not a fan of that kind of language," I said, "but I'll give you a pass since you're upset. What's your name?"
"Mark Despot."
"That isn't a real name."
"It's my fighting name," he said,
and opened his shirt slightly to show the gothic black X inked across his pectorals and abdomen, the crux right over his breastbone.
"I'm a professional MMA fighter. Right now I'm 5-7, but I've been undefeated in my last 4 scraps. Who are you?"
"I'm Honeysuckle Speck."
"Kind of name is that?"
"That'd be my fighting name." He stared at me in bewilderment for a moment over the fist he still held close to his mouth. Then misery overtook him, and his shoulders heaved with another sob, blowing snot and spit in the process. When movie stars grieve in the tragic third act of a love story, they always make mourning look a lot more beautiful than it really is. Roswell peered from Mark to me and mewled in a weak, shivery voice. He was trembling. I stroked one hand along his smooth, downy flank. You never saw a creature asking for relief any more clearly.
"I don't know what to do for him," Mark said. "There is only one thing left you can do for him." "I can't," he said, and another sob burst out of him. "Ain't no way. We have been friends for 10 years.
10 years is a good life for a cat.
"He has been with me from Tucumcari to Spokane. I had him when I didn't have nothing else except the shirt on my back. I just can't do that."
"No, of course you can't," I said. "Go on and pet him. He's looking for comfort." He reached out one big, gnarly hand and rubbed at Roswell's head as tenderly as a man stroking the face of a newborn. Roswell shut his eyes and pressed his skull up into Mark's palm and gave a soft, rattling purr. He was stretched out in a sticky puddle of blood, but he had the bright sun on his flank and his companion's hand on his brow.
"Oh, Roswell," he said, "a man never had a better pal."
He drew his hand back to his mouth, heaving with fresh tears, and shut his eyes. I suppose that was as good a time as any, so I reached out and took Roswell's head in one hand and his neck in the other and gave a good, firm twist, same as I would have done with a chicken on my father's old farm. Mark Despot's eyes flew open. He stiffened, went rigid with shock.
"What did you do?" he asked, like he didn't know.
"It's over," I said. He was suffering.
"No!"
he shouted, but I didn't think he was shouting at me or shouting about what I'd done. He was shouting at God for taking away his cat. He was shouting at his own unhappy heart.
"Oh, shit! Oh, shit, Roswell!"
He slid off the bottom step of the bus and onto his knees. Roswell was curled up on his side in a red splash of blood. Mark Despot took his limp body in both hands, pulling him close, lifting him up, hugging him. I touched Despot's arm, and he knocked my hand aside with his elbow.
"Get the fuck away from me," he cried. "I didn't ask you to do that. You didn't have any right."
"I'm sorry, but it was for the best. That cat was in agony."
"So who asked you? Did I ask you?"
There was nothing that could have saved Roswell.
"You don't get moving, you filthy Les," he said. "There's nothing going to be able to save you."
I didn't pay any mind to that.
He was hurting. The whole world was. I dug in my bag and offered Mark the Spot a bottle of water. He didn't look at it, and he didn't look at me, so I put it down in the road next to his hip. Close up, I could see he was younger than I'd thought at first. He might have been no older than me. I felt sympathy for him, in spite of his nasty mouth and childish ways. I was all alone in the world, too. I got up and went on, but when I'd covered another 3 blocks, I happened to glance back and discovered that Mark the Spot was following me. He staggered like a drunk, about 100 feet behind, and when I looked at him, he quickly turned away and pretended to be staring through a smashed plate glass window into the darkened interior of a second-hand electronics store. He had produced a white straw cowboy hat from somewhere, and with that on his head and a red bandana around his throat, he looked more like a youthful vaquero than ever. The sight of him trailing along behind me made me ill at ease. In our brief encounter, he had struck me as the kind of person who was a victim of his own emotions, impulsive and immature. It occurred to me now that he might have made up his mind I was a sadistic breaker of hearts and slayer of felines, and that he was cruising to express his displeasure with a closed fist. Or maybe he was looking to improve his fighting record to 6 wins by hauling off and belting a lonely lesbian with an unfortunate resemblance to Squiggy. I went on, though, and in another block was able to take a deep breath. If he'd been hoping to jump me, he'd lost his chance. As Broadway descended south into Lower Chautauqua, it became steadily more crowded. I heard a noisy rumble, and an enormous dump truck with chains on its tires turned onto the street in front of me. Shiny nails of crystal imploded under its wheels. A big dude in a filthy yellow jumpsuit and elbow-length rubber gloves rode on the back end. Behind him, the flatbed was stacked 3 deep with corpses. The truck wove around abandoned cars, and when there wasn't room to go around, it went through, bashing wrecks out of its way. It joined a slow-moving caravan of other dump trucks. They were lined up to turn into a football field behind the high school. It seemed like half of Boulder was there, wandering in a daze. Packs of children with grimy faces, old ladies in house coats. When I got closer, I could see dead people laid out in rows along the yard lines of the football field, from one set of goalposts to the other. The trucks were collecting the dead, and family members had followed in their wake to see that the remains of their loved ones were treated right. You would expect them all to be sobbing, for the field to be a Greek chorus of wails and screams, but people were better behaved than that. We're people of the heartland. We don't make too much of a fuss. It seems impolite. I imagine that a lot of people were too sleepless and shocked to carry on. Maybe it would have felt rude to rend your clothes and tear your hair with so many other grief-stricken people around. There were folding tables set up at one end of the field, manned by 2 crews, a team from Staples and a gang of kids from McDonald's. The McDonald's squad had a few charcoal braziers going. Under the diesel stink of the trucks, I could make out the cheery, greasy odor of McMuffins and burgers. A line of about 20 people led up to the tables. I don't know why I got into the queue. Maybe it was that hungry-making smell, or maybe I was thinking I could see if there was a place here for Yolanda and her mother. Maybe I was just hoping Mark the Spot would lose interest and decide to stop trailing me now that I was in a crowd. He was still there, pretending not to look at me but hovering at the outskirts of the action. I waited my turn, and when I got up to the table, a tall, gawky gal wearing a pair of giant glasses and a red Staples shirt said, "Are you looking for someone or bringing someone in?" In front of her, she had a set of rotary files and a bag full of manila tags. "Neither right yet. How does it all work?" "Staples will tag your loved one and file their location on the field for future reference. If you have a Staples Rewards account, we'll even email you all the burial information. It's all free to show our commitment to rebuilding the greater Boulder area through the combined forces of local volunteers and Staples' great products and services." She recited her lines in a dazed drone. "I might want to bring my friend and her mom down. I don't know yet. It'd be a long way to haul them. We're arranging pickups, too, but it might be 3 to 4 days. "Will there even be any room left on the field by then?" I asked. She nodded. "Yes, absolutely. We're burying the first wave at 1 p.m. There will be prayers from 6 different faiths, and Scissor will provide catering. She pointed to some other trucks under the goalposts filled with dirt and rocks. After we cover them over, I'm afraid it'll be necessary to bury another group on top of them. We're hoping to manage 3 a plot.
I'll think about it, I said, and she nodded. And then a teenager standing beside her asked if I wanted large fries or an Egg McMuffin and told me that McDonald's wanted to express their sorrow for my loss. It was the end of the world, but you could still hit the drive-thru on your way to oblivion.
Of course it was good of them all to be doing what they were doing, helping folks lay their loved ones to rest and making sure everyone got fed. When the sky starts raining nails, you find out pretty fast what parts of a culture are the sturdiest. One thing Americans do well is make an assembly line. Not 24 hours after a few thousand people were ripped to shreds by falling needles, and we were burying our dead with all the efficiency of packing a Happy Meal. I got out of there, tucking into my fries. You might not think it's possible to have an appetite walking past a carpet of dead bodies 100 yards long, but foreground becomes background pretty quick. Any pattern repeated over and over is bound to turn into wallpaper eventually, whether it's flowers or corpses. After the fries were gone and I'd licked all the tasty grease off my fingers, I downed half a bottle of water in a hurry to rinse the salt taste out of my mouth. By then I was sometimes seeing faint little sparkles and flashes of light at the edges of my vision, which was maybe the sun glinting on all the scattered nails, or was maybe just lightheadedness. It didn't seem like I'd been walking long enough to get faint. But then the night before had been a restless one. I hadn't gone far when I caught sight of Mark Despot again, hanging back about a block. He dropped his gaze straight away and acted like he was interested in the football field, but I knew then he was still after me. I swerved toward a Starbucks on the corner as if I wanted a latte to wash down my fries. The door was locked, of course. Any fool could have guessed it wasn't going to be open. But I gave the handle a tug like I expected otherwise. I peered through the tinted glass as if there were someone in there to look at. Actually, the lights were off, and there was a paper sign taped up on the door. Closed for the end of the human race. But I gave a thumbs up and nodded as if someone had told me to use the side door. I slipped around the corner of the building and then busted out the best run I could manage in my shit kickers. There was a wide swath of parking lot on the other side of Starbucks, filled with 1,000 crystal nails gleaming and throwing halos. It looked like all the treasures of Aladdin had been dumped off in front of Whole Foods. I ran about halfway across the lot, then hunkered down behind someone's grape-colored Kia. I watched the Starbucks, looking through the space between the undercarriage and the asphalt. Sure enough, Mark Despot soon came wandering around the corner, peering this way and that, hunting for me. Then he looked over his shoulder, as if someone were following him. After a moment of indecision, he turned around and went back the way he'd come. I sat and counted 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, until I reached 100. I got up and went crunching on across the lot, down Baseline Road, and onto the ramp leading up to the turnpike. I thought there might be sawhorses blocking the way, but the ramp was wide open, aside from a little hatchback that had somehow caught fire and burnt down to the frame. Once I reached the turnpike, I could see in a glance there was nothing to stop me from strolling all the way to Denver right along the dotted yellow line. When the rain had come down, it was going 10 in the morning on a pretty Monday in August. On the turnpike, cars had been doing 70 when the storm broke. Must have been like driving into anti-aircraft fire. I saw a black Corvette that had been peeled open, the whole roof twisted back, the red leather seats inside ground up into hamburger. Then I looked again and saw it wasn't red leather at all. They were white seats that had been painted red by what had happened to the people sitting on them. There were other folks strolling along the pike, picking over the wrecks. One middle-aged lady had a shopping cart. I watched her stop alongside a Mercedes to mine the glove compartment. She was about 40, had a pink flowered kerchief over her graying hair, and the tidy, put-together look of a PTA mom. She dug through someone's blood-stained purse, found some bills, a gold bracelet, and a copy of 50 Shades Freed, which she deposited into her cart before going on. A mile away, on the other side of the road, I spied a crew dressed in orange jumpsuits doing some kind of work. It was too far away to see what. Well, It was a nice morning for walking, as long as you paid no mind to all the dead folks chewed up in their cars. I was down to about 25% battery on my phone, but I was longing to hear another human voice, so I stuck in my earbuds to catch some news. That's why I didn't hear them coming up on me, the Comet Boys. That's why they got me. What I heard on the news was that preliminary evidence indicated the terrorists who'd made it rain nails might have been operating out of an area around the Black Sea. There was a company based in the region that had demonstrated a reagent that could rapidly produce synthetic fulgurite under laboratory conditions. The president had dashed to Twitter to promise a biblical response and a holy war, and swore that the Islamists were about to learn that when it rains, it pours. He said we'd be dropping a shower of our own soon enough, only it would be daisy cutters, not a bunch of namby-pamby crystal nails. Then there was a story about a fierce downpour in Pueblo, all nails, that punctured natural gas tanks and caused an explosion so tremendous it registered as an earthquake in Colorado Springs. They said the fire had swallowed half the town, and the trucks couldn't get close enough to effectively battle it because they couldn't traverse the nail-studded roads. A meteorologist said the crystal spikes in Pueblo were larger than the ones in Denver, with some darts as long as his thumb. A chemical engineer was just about to explain what it all meant, but I didn't hear what he had to say, because that was when someone clubbed me in the head. I went down so hard and fast I don't remember hitting the ground. I wasn't knocked out. It was more like when the lights in your house flicker just a bit. There was a little mental flicker, and when my head cleared, I was on all fours, seeing stars. That's not a turn of phrase. I mean literally. I was looking down at a copper disc the size of a saucer, with constellations etched on it and my blood gilding one edge. The Comet Kids were coming up through the waist-high blonde grass at the side of the pike, moving fast in their tinfoil gowns. It was the three who'd been wrapping up Mr. Waldman. The boy who resembled Christ had thrown his astrolabe into my head. The other two had pulled their astrolabes off their necks and were whipping them around and around in big loops. The spinning gold medallions droned like a pair of didgeridoos. My hands and knees were torn up from my fall. The road was carpeted in shiny tacks. I touched the crown of my head, and a pulse of blue light blinked in front of my eyes. I felt a deep throb of pain, like someone had whopped a railroad spike into my skull. When I could see again, my right hand had 10 fingers instead of 5, and all of them were wet with blood. I still had one earbud poked into my ear, and I heard a snatch of someone on the news, murmuring in a weird, deep, underwater voice. "You just don't believe the sky can really fall on you, but guess what? It's falling now." I couldn't figure out why they wanted to pick a fight with me, and I didn't feel like hanging around to ask them. I scooped myself up and tried to run, but I was woozing and reeling from the thwack in the head. I staggered this way and that, and then another comet clown let go of his astrolabe, and it hit me in the small of the back. It was like getting stabbed. My knees folded, and I dropped again. I hit face first and caught a chinful of fulgurite stickers. Fortunately, by then I had staggered to the edge of the road, and I fell into thick grass instead of against hard blacktop and rolled a few feet down the embankment. I felt the way I imagine a caterpillar must when she's closed into the fuzzy shroud of her cocoon. I could hear, and I could see a little, although everything had gone cloudy and out of focus, but I couldn't feel my limbs, which were numb and boneless. All the thought had been knocked out of me. I wasn't even in what you might call pain. I didn't have enough sensation to feel pain. They crowded in. I could see past them, too. The action had drawn the attention of the PTA mom pushing her shopping cart. She craned her head to see what was happening, her expression nervous but also excited. The fat boy saw her looking and hissed, "Oh, man, oh, shit, we shouldn't have done this right here, Sean, where people can see." "Shut up, Pat," said the one who looked like Christ. Of course the fat boy was named Pat. I've never seen anyone who was more Pat in his life. Sean, Christ in a tinfoil gown, glanced up the embankment at the PTA mom. "It's for her own good," he told her. "She's crazy. We're bringing her home to look after her. Right, Randy?"
The black kid who had vitiligo nodded with a frantic enthusiasm. "She gets like this when she's off her meds. She thinks everyone's after her."
"Can't imagine what gave her that idea," the PTA mom said.
"You want her iPhone?" Randy gobbled. He had a querulous, jittery sort of voice. He picked my phone out of the dirt, dusted it off, and held it out to her. "It's a new one."
"The 7?
"The 7 Plus. Take it. We just don't want any trouble."
"That's right," Sean said. "We're doing what's best for her and for us. Same as you're doing what's best for you, even though the police might not see it that way. A cop might think you're looting when really you're just surviving, aren't you?"
Her face assumed a faintly sulky cast. "The people I took from aren't going to complain."
"No, they won't. And this girl is mentally feeble and hysterical and needs looking after by her family. But some people might say we're committing abuse, dragging her back home this way. It's easiest to mind your own business, don't you think?"
She didn't reply for a moment, but went on staring at the phone in Randy's hand. "I always wanted to try the bigger one, but I bet you can't unlock it."
"Bet we can. It's the one works off fingerprints," Sean said.
He nodded at Randy, who bent down and grabbed my hand and squeezed my thumb against the sensor. The phone unlocked with an audible click. Randy tossed it to PTA Mom, who caught it in both hands. In his nervous, twitchy voice, Randy said,
"You'll want to reset the security right away before it locks itself again."
"Enjoy it," Sean said. "Think different. We do."
She laughed. "Huh, I can see that. Take care of the poor girl." And she turned and puttered off, playing with my phone.
My insides hurt at the thought of losing it. It had all my text messages from Yolanda on it. She would send me pictures of the sky, big blue western skies with little lumps of white cloud in them, and she'd write, "The cloud in the middle is my pet unicorn," or, "That cloud over the mountains is you hiding under a sheet." Once she sent me a picture of a mountain pool, a cloud reflected in it as if it were a mile-wide mirror, and texted, "I want to hold you like the water holds the sky." Seeing that woman wander off with my phone was worse than getting my head smashed in with an astrolabe. It was like wrapping Yolanda in her shroud all over again. Randy, Pat, and Sean watched her go with hunted, rascally eyes. You never saw a more demented-looking pack of weasels. I tried to move, to rise onto all fours, and just the thought of the effort pushed a sound out of me, something between a sob and a groan. That got their attention back. They circled me again.
"Do you know what the best thing would be, guys?"
"Guys!"
Pat said. He was the kind of huffy, breathless boy who's always saying things that no one else listens to.
"Guys, I think it would be easiest to kill this bitch. We could bang a nail into her temple. No one would ever know she didn't die in the rain."
"The finders would know," said Sean. "The finders would see homicide in your mind and leave your quantum energy to fall into dissolution with all the others who are unprepared."
Or something like that. I've never had much of a grip on their cuckoo bird theology. I think the finders might be a higher breed of intelligence. And your soul, I guess, is your quantum energy. It's hard to believe anyone could choke down Elder Bent's fourth-rate Flash Gordon story. But humans are pack animals by nature, and most will accept whatever they have to accept, wholly, enthusiastically, to keep an honored place in their tribe. Give a man a choice between reality and loneliness or fantasy and community, he'll pick having friends every time.
"It's not just the finders we got to worry about," Randy said, wiping a hand under his nose and sniffing. "She dragged Yolanda and Yolanda's ma into the house across the street. You know where the vampire kid lives."
"Yeah, the Blakes," said Sean. "Who cares about them?"
"Well, wouldn't the woman wonder when she never hears from Honeysuckle again? I bet she's expecting her to check in."
"If Ursula Blake and her creepy little kid turn out to be a problem, then we'll deal with them like we're going to deal with her," Sean said. "It's not like we have to worry about getting locked up. Humanity will be extinct before the year is out. There's not a prison in the world that can hold us, boys. We've got an escape tunnel that goes all the way to the 7th dimension."
"It's funny. The world always manages to ensnare you, even when you're most sure you're free and clear of its hooks. After I wrapped up Yolanda and said goodbye to her, it seemed to me that I'd come unplugged from the emotional charge that keeps most of us going, day in, day out.
I was like a circuit board that had been popped out of the big, lively, whirring machine of human society. I didn't serve anyone. I didn't solve anything. I didn't have any useful functions to offer. Without Yolanda, I was obsolete hardware. Then Sean started talking about going after Ursula and Templeton, who had taken me into their house when I was in shock, fed me, and tended to me. And I felt a sick frisson of alarm that finally sent some strength to my limbs. Not enough to do me any good, mind you. I tried to get on my hands and knees, and Sean put his boot in my ass and slammed me back down onto my face. Lying there with my nostrils full of dust and needles sticking into my chest, it came to me that if anything happened to Ursula and her son on my account, I wouldn't be able to bear it. "Yeah, that's right, Sean. The big flash is coming," Randy said. "In 10 weeks, Ursula Blake, her kid, Honeysuckle, they're dead meat, along with all the rest of the disorganized, and we'll be with the Finders." "Learning how to make universes of our own," Pat whispered in a reverential hush. So what do we decide?" Randy said, and he licked dry lips with a sandpapery tongue. "Nail her?" "No, better. Save her," Sean said. "We'll bring her back to Elderbend and force an awakening. Come on, let's wrap her up." He drew a big folded square of that crinkly foil-like material out of a backpack and spread it on the ground next to me. The other two wrapped me in it just like they were rolling up carpet. I tried to kick my way loose, but I was too weak to work up a decent struggle, and in a minute they had me wound up with my arms pinned to my sides and that tough, shiny fabric wrapped around me from ankle to throat. Sean was down on one knee with a roll of black electrical tape, binding my silver cloak tight around me when I hawked a fat gob of spit into one of his eyes. He flinched. Pat shrieked, "Gross!" Sean wiped his eye and glared at me. "If I were you, I'd save my spit. Elder Bent takes the view that physical suffering prepares your spiritual energies to leave the body behind. You aren't likely to get much to drink in the next couple months." "If physical suffering is good for building up spiritual energy," called someone from up in the road, "I'm about to fully recharge your batteries. Get ready for a high-voltage ass-kicking, you sons of bitches." We all looked around, and there was Mark Despot, who I thought I'd ditched back at Starbucks. His stony visage stared up beneath the brim of his cowboy hat. His shirt flapped open to show the magnificent black X inked across his reddish-bronze chest. His right hand was clenched in a fist. Nails stuck up between his fingers. The Three Stooges gathered around me had one moment to gawp before he fell upon them, dropping down the side of the embankment so fast his hat flapped off. Randy was the only one of them who still had an astrolabe to fight with. He was pulling it from around his neck when Despot got to him, throwing all his weight behind his right fist. He hit Randy so hard they both fell over. The side of Randy's face was raked off like he'd been struck with a gardening fork. Despot's nail-studded fist clawed deep red furrows in his cheek, puncturing straight through into his mouth. The one named Pat screamed, then turned and ran. He tripped over me with both feet and hit the dirt. Well, that was his one and only chance to get away. By then, Mark Despot was back up, growling like a dog, sick from the heat. He caught up to Pat and kicked him in the ass and drove him back down onto his stomach. Pat flattened with a cough. Mark kept going, grabbed him by the collar, and yanked his head back. He grabbed Pat's nose and gave it a horrible twist. It made a sharp, brittle crack, a sound like someone stepping on a china plate. To this day, I have never heard another sound so horrible. He dropped Pat, and the chubby boy went down squirming in a kind of palsy. In all this time, Sean, the team's Christ lookalike, hadn't moved. He stood frozen, his eyes wide, his face rigid. When he heard Pat's nose crack, though, it broke his paralysis, and he turned to run. I guess it doesn't hurt your quantum energy none to be a lick-spittle coward who leaves your buddies in the dirt. Despot caught up to him in three lunging steps, snatched him by the back of the tinfoil gown, and yanked him right off his feet. As Sean fell backward, Despot snapped up his right knee and clubbed him in the base of the skull. If that was how he fought in the ring, I never wanted to meet any of the men who'd beaten him. Sean stared up at him, his eyes rolling like those of a panicked horse. Mark was about to stomp on his face when I hollered, "Wait!" Mark glanced at me with an irritable frown, like he thought I was going soft and womanly on him. I rocked to the left, then to the right, and finally I was able to roll across the slope until I thumped up alongside Sean. We were stretched out side by side, me in my shroud of silver wrap, him in the weeds with Mark's boot resting on his chest. I stared up into Despot's face and said, "They were following me?" He peered down at me, his brow furrowed. "All morning long. I was sitting there with Roswell when I saw them the first time. Following you from two blocks back. Didn't look right, so I figured I'd trail along and see what they wanted with you. Thought it was the least I could do. When I had a minute to collect myself, I kind of got to feeling like I owed you." We latched gazes, but only for a moment. He blushed and looked away. I twisted my head to stare into Sean's dazed, frightened face. "Why the hell would you and your empty-headed pals follow me 5 miles just to bushwhack me, 3 against 1? What did I ever do to you besides make fun of the way you dress and the way you talk and all your stupid crackpot ideas?" His voice, when he spoke, was rusty and thin. "You were going to tell. You were walking to Denver to meet with the FBI and tell them what we'd been up to. You were going to tell them that Elder Bent, of all men, knew the rains would fall. He knew. He was foretold." "What do you mean he was foretold?"
"He knew what was coming. He knew the hour and the day when the ignorant would be cut down, leaving behind only the prepared. Only us."
I considered that for a moment, then said, "And what gave Elder Bent the idea I was going to the FBI? Did he get that information from one of his contacts in the 7th dimension?" Sean bit down on his lower lip as if he felt he had already said too much. Mark Despot put his weight on his left foot, pressing down against Sean's chest, and the air exploded out of the kid.
"The Russian!" he cried. "He left a message! It said you knew what we had been up to, and if we didn't stop you, Elder Bent would be hauled away by the FBI because of what he knew about the rains."
"Andropov left you a message?" Sean let out a little laughing gasp.
"Yeah."
And in an atrocious Russian accent, he said,
"You must stop me's on his suck. Girl's going to talk to FBI."
"I don't think he wants the law digging around the neighborhood any more than we do." "Who talked to him?" I asked. "Who took his message? Did he say anything else?" But it turned out we were all done talking. This whole time, the one named Randy had been surreptitiously crawling away through the high grass. When he reached the edge of the road, he got up and hot-footed it. Despot saw him making his break and snatched up one of the big astrolabes that had brought me down. He didn't bother with the gold chain, but threw it like a frisbee, and it hit the back of Randy's head with the kind of gong that would have been quite amusing in a slapstick cartoon. Randy collapsed. While this was happening, Sean scrambled to his knees. A blade flashed in one hand. I recognized it right off. It was my own knife, part of the little multi-tool I had stuck in my backpack. Before he could poke it into Mark's kidneys, I twisted and threw my legs and swept his feet out from beneath him. Sean toppled backward down the embankment. His head struck the shallow, concrete-lined ditch at the bottom with a sickening crunch. I shouted for Mark to have a look and make sure I hadn't just murdered him. Mark knelt beside him at the base of the slope, took his pulse, and looked into his eyes. He glanced up at me with a sorry, disappointed look on his battered face.
"Bad luck," he said. "I think he's fine. Just out cold."
He came back to me at a rangy lope and bent and started ripping tape free.
"You almost lost me back at Starbucks," he said.
"I didn't nearly lose them, I guess. I feel like a fool for not realizing they were after me. Dressed like they are, they should have stood out like flashing lights."
"It's easier for 3 people to tail a person than one. Besides," he held up a set of connected brass cylinders, "they could stay farther back and still follow you. Your boyfriend down there had a telescope."
By then he was pulling that silver shroud free. It looked like tinfoil, but it was as resilient as canvas. It flashed the sun into my eyes, and in that instant it struck me that maybe I'd come close to spotting them after all.
I remembered sometimes noticing a sparkle and glint at the very periphery of my vision and wondering if I was getting faint. That had been them, hanging back, hiding in doorways, shadowing me from a distance. Mark was looking glum and avoiding my gaze, folding and unfolding that big sheet of silver packing material. I thought I knew what was troubling him. "You can stop worrying about what you said to me when you were so upset," I told him. "We're even now. More than even. I'm awfully sorry about what I had to do to Roswell." He nodded.
"Yeah, well."
"What's your real name? Mark the Spot is the kind of joke that would amuse a 5-year-old.
He glared, then said, "DeSoto. No money in a name like that."
He looked around him at the comic clowns.
"Did you understand any of what he said to you?"
I sat up and stretched. Some of what Sean had babbled was the usual cosmic rubbish spouted by all Elder Bent's people. But I thought there'd been fragments of something that mattered mixed in with all Sean's space cadet nonsense. I needed time to try to untangle it in my head, see if I could make some sense of it. When I didn't reply, Mark murmured a little uneasily,
"He said this Elder Bent knew what was going to happen, that they were all preparing for it. You think there's any chance?"
His voice trailed off. I didn't know, and I didn't answer. Instead, I said, "Some nasty old biddy gave me up to these white slavers here just to get my iPhone Plus. She walked off without a look back."
"The one with the shopping cart? I saw her."
He picked his hat out of the dirt and set it on his head. "I guess losing my phone isn't the worst thing. I could be on my way to a dank basement cell in a house full of end-of-the-world cultists, forced to do who knows what to satisfy their demented wishes." I had an urge to get up and walk around, kicking all the comic kids in their heads, but it was hot and I had a long road still ahead of me. "Can you think of any way we can keep them from getting up and coming after me again, or of going after you?" He opened Sean's telescope and peered down the turnpike.
"Those are convicts working on the highway, sweeping up nails under the eye of the state police. Why don't you wander down there and tell them you've got 3 more that belong in leg irons? I'll tape them up in their shiny dresses the way they taped you up so they don't wander off."
He offered me a hand, and I took it. He pulled me to my feet. We stood together in a tired, comradely silence for a moment. He squinted at the blue sky.
"You think these boys are right? You think these are the end times? I had an aunt who said it was a matter of fact that this was the last human century. Anyone who understood the Book of Revelation could see a judgment was coming."
"I hate the idea these blockheads could be right about anything," I said. "Tell you what, though. If the apocalypse holds off another couple of days, why don't you stop by the White House on Jackdaw Street with the staircase on the outside of the building? Or look for me across the street at the little butter-colored ranch where my friend Ursula lives with her son. We can have a couple beers and try to brainstorm a better fighting name for you than Mark the Spot." He grinned, flapped his blue denim shirt open.
"Too late. Once you got a big X on your chest, who else could you be?"
"The X-Terminator?"
"I thought about X-rated, but a lot of kids come to the fights. You don't want to give their parents the wrong idea."
"Thanks for rescuing me, friend," I said. "Try to stay out of the rain."
"You too," he said to me.
He squeezed my hand then, turned, and descended the hill to Sean. I hung out long enough to watch as he began to wrestle with Sean's gown, tucking his arms inside it, wrapping it tight around him. I didn't think I'd ever see Mark the Spot again, and wished there were more to say, but it seemed like we'd already said everything that mattered. Some people you can never thank enough, so you might as well quit after saying it once, because too much gratitude will just make them embarrassed. I turned on my heel, crystal pins grinding under my boots, and went on into the noonday light. Behind me I heard the first loud ripping sound as Mark the Spot tore off a strip of tape. It was a hot, dusty half an hour walking up the turnpike to the chain gang. As I approached, a state trooper who'd been leaning against the hood of an abandoned red Audi stood up and stared at me through a pair of mirrored sunglasses. Strung out behind him, there were maybe 30 convicts wearing orange jumpsuits that said Supermax on the back. Most of the prisoners had push brooms and were sweeping the nails from the road. Maybe six others were working in teams of two to wrestle corpses out of cars and fling them onto a flatbed trailer, latched to a monstrous John Deere tractor down in the grass. The tractor had heavy chains on the tires, but I'm not sure it needed them. The tires themselves were as big as doors, so thick and massive that I doubt the sharpest of those crystal darts could have pierced them. Another couple of stadies were starting the cars that could be started and driving them to the center island between the east and westbound lanes. They had cleared the turnpike all the way to Denver, the road open and empty and quiet. The skyscrapers of the city soared pale blue and distant below us. "Is your business?" asked the cop who'd been sitting against the Audi. He adjusted the elephant rifle propped against his shoulder. A lot of the convicts had paused to look up from their sweeping. They'd been at it all morning and smelled that way. It was a ripe man stink, mingled with the corrupted meat smell of blood baking into the upholstery of all those ditched cars. 100,000 flies had been born overnight. The air seemed to vibrate from the beehive hum of them. "There's three boys back that way you might want to talk to. They bushwhacked me as I was headed down from Boulder to Denver and tried to abduct me for their end-of-the-world cult. They would have got me, too, if I wasn't rescued by a good Samaritan who beat the pants off them. He left them taped up in the silver gowns they were wearing. Also, there was a woman with a shopping cart who agreed to turn a blind eye to my kidnapping and trade for my iPhone Plus. But you don't need to bother with her. A cell phone seems a small thing to worry about in the midst of a national crisis."
"Got blood in your hair," said the state trooper in the aviator glasses.
"Yes, sir. One of them belted me with a chain." I didn't want to say they had attacked me with astronomical instruments, on account of I didn't feel that would make my story any more credible.
"Let me see," he said.
I ducked my head and gestured to where I'd been struck. He pushed a few rough, calloused fingers into my hair, then drew his hand back and wiped his red fingertips off on the hip of his uniform. "This needs stitches." He had the clipped, disinterested inflections of Yul Brynner, but for all that, he'd inspected my injury with sensitivity, and the blood on his hands didn't bother him. "In the West you will find men like that, fellows with gentle hands and hard, flat voices. Horses and dogs are instinctively loyal to such fellows, while yellow bellies and equivocators instinctively fear them. They make mediocre husbands, good officers of the law, and top-notch bank robbers." He half-turned and called out, "Dillett! You do a couple stitches for the lady?" There was a skinny gink in a state police uniform, a guy who was mostly knees and Adam's apple, standing in the flatbed behind the tractor, using a pitchfork to move bodies around. He paused and waved his gray felt campaign hat in acknowledgement. The head guard looked down into my face and said, "You shouldn't be walking in this road anyway. We're in a state of emergency. Unless someone is dying, you shouldn't be in the open." "It's not someone dying. It's someone dead. My girlfriend and her mother were struck down in the storm, and I set out for Denver to let her father know." He looked away from me and shook his head like his team just gave up a big lead in the late innings. He didn't express any condolences, but he did say,
"And you were going to walk all the way there from Boulder to Denver? What if it rains again?"
"I'd hide under a car, I guess."
"It can be hard to tell the difference between decency and stupidity sometimes. I'm not sure which side of the line this one falls on. But I'll take a couple of my guys up the pike, and if I come across this gang of curl nappers, I'll radio back. Officer Dillard will haul you down to Denver on his dad's John Deere. He's got a full load of dead folks to drag back to town anyway. You'll have to make a statement to authorities there."
"Yes, sir," I said. "What are you guys going to do if it rains?"
"What are all of you going to do?"
"Take cover and start sweeping again when it's over. If the roads aren't clear, what good are they? If a government can't keep the roads open, what good is a government at all?"
He cast an unhappy look at the sky and said,
"Wouldn't that be a sad epitaph for the world? Democracy was canceled on account of rain. The human season will be suspended until further notice."
If he knew he'd just said some poetry, his sunburned, hard-ass Yul Brynner face didn't show it.
"Yes, sir. We'll hope for sun. And try not to worry about how we're going to raise crops when the clouds are spilling rocks instead of water." "Yes, sir." I crunched over the loose gravel of 1,000 diamond bright needles and said hello to Dillett, the skinny gink on the flatbed. He said to climb up on the bumper and he'd have a look at my scalp. Strange to say, that was the best part of that whole long, menacing nightmare of a weekend. I took a shine to Dillett, who was as gangly and loose-jointed as the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz and just as friendly. He pulled on latex gloves and threaded shut my scalp wound,